Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon and welcome to this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We are joined by our friend Doug Keck at the open of this hour to talk about the moral crisis that we're facing in the public sphere. A moral crisis really is, as I've spoken about in the past, a reflection of two competing visions of morality. We cannot at the same time espouse a religious political worldview, a religious morality, and then try to live a secular worldview. And that's the problem we're having. A religious moral perspective, paradigm, that's in conflict with a secular moral paradigm. And the former being grounded in Judeo-Christian tradition, but the latter in radical and especially modern notions of liberty, equality, and this is tearing society asunder. This continues that conversation that we've been having about the divide that we're seeing in the public sphere. So we're joined by Doug Keck to speak about this. And this is in light of a book written by Bill Donahue entitled Cultural Meltdown, The Secular Roots of Our Moral Crisis. We move on from there to speak with my friend Paul Kengor about John Paul II and the fall of the Berlin Wall. This is, at this point, common fact. I remember speaking with George Weigel some time ago, and he said that when he was first encountering research for writing the biography of John Paul II, many people didn't know just how significant a role he played in the tearing down of the Berlin Wall. But by now, this is historical fact. John Paul II was one of the key players in the tearing down of the Berlin Wall and bringing down this great Iron Curtain. So we'll talk about why we mustn't overlook his key role and what we can learn from it today, because what John Paul II did was really fight for the common stance of the Church in the flourishing of the human person. And we celebrate its 35th anniversary on November the 9th. And then finally, we speak with Stacey Manning about flipping the script on the conversation about global children's rights movement. It's a wonderful book that Stacey has authored alongside Katie Faust. It's entitled Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. And really it appeals to, yes, we have some divine revelation law in there, but really it appeals to logic, to science, and to natural law as to why fighting for the rights of children makes sense for the flourishing of the family and marriage. All of this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, November 11th. It's the Feast of St. Martin of Tours. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. President Biden says the country has a sacred obligation to those who have served and their families.
Prepare those we send into harm's way and to care for them and their families when they return home and when they don't.
He marked his final Veterans Day as Commander-in-Chief at Arlington National Cemetery. Former ICE Director Tom Homan will become the nation's border czar when President-elect Trump takes office. Homan says he won't hesitate to deport those who are in the country illegally, something he claims the current administration hasn't done.
You have the right to claim asylum. You have the right to see a judge, and we make that happen. But at the end of that due process, and the judge says you must go home, then we have to take them home. Because if we're not, what the hell are we doing?
Homan says he also plans to resume large-scale worksite raids, which he says have stopped under President Biden. Classes were canceled today at Tuskegee University following a Sunday shooting that left an 18-year-old dead and 16 others injured. Tuskegee Mayor Lawrence Haygood Jr. says there was a strong police presence on campus for this weekend's homecoming activities, but not in the area where the shooting happened.
This occurred in an area that no one knew about. It was unauthorized, so there would have been security there, I'm sure, had it been a planned event.
25-year-old suspect Jaquez Myrick was arrested as he left the scene having possession of a machine gun. And the bells of Notre Dame are once again ringing out in Paris for the first time since 2019. The 855-year-old cathedral received three new bells last week as it prepares to reopen following the devastating fire. The landmark is scheduled to reopen December 8th and is anticipated to have 14 to 15 million visitors annually. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Joining me as he does every Monday is my friend Doug Keck, President and CEO of EWTN, and we are talking about Bill Donahue's book, Cultural Meltdown, The Secular Roots of Our Moral Crisis. Doug, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you. It's always an engaging conversation. Thanks, Marcus.
Likewise, I always greatly enjoy our segments. And you and I have spoken before, at length actually, about the notion of the cultural meltdown and these conflicting religious and a-religious moral systems that are at war in our public sphere. So let's open the conversation there.
Yeah, absolutely. The book, Cultural Meltdown, our good friend Bill Donahue, who I've known since I lived in New York, on Long Island in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. and obviously for the Catholic League, has always been at the forefront of pointing out those kind of secular intrusions into religious liberty, especially into the Catholic faith. And really, he wrote this book particularly as an answer to a lot of people saying, what's wrong? How come everything is upside down? You know, what mm-hmm. was black is now white. What was good is now bad. It's like we're in kind of Twilight Zone world where again, I always think of, there was an episode of Star Trek years ago called Mirror, Mirror, which was about a parallel universe where everything was in reverse. And it's kind of like what we woke up and found ourselves there, right, in a world of moral relativism and secularism gone awry. And really, we've had our own cultural meltdown. Obviously, we've seen it. And I think we can see that a lot of people have woken up to it recently. And I think that was indicated by the results of the recent election.
You know, Doug, we can trace this movement pretty far back historically, but we really see this massive explosion of a kind of moral relativism in the sexual revolution that took the United States by storm. And with that, the notion of moral absolute for sexuality for the human person got cast out the window. And so we've seen, you know, the devolution of marriage and the family and ultimately society crumbling. This hasn't brought about positive effects for society. If anything, we're suffering from it.
Absolutely. And we know, because we're dealing with the idea that so many things no longer that we believe to be true are considered true anymore, because you have your truth, I have mine. Mm-hmm. So things are, you know, always up for grabs. There's this conception of the world as a simply a social construct. Right. According to that, there's no constraints, in which case you can be, as Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy said, basically talking about the idea that one can create their own reality. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing lived out. Well, the reality is there is one truth. It's Jesus Christ. And whether you believe in him, he believes in you, and whether you like it or not, the natural law that God has set up is there, and you can bang your head against it, but you're going to get a headache.
And that's completely true, because trying to bang your head against the natural law is like trying to bang your head against a solid brick wall. There's a certain eternal quality to this. This came from the divine mind, and it's been endowed upon the human person by virtue of our carrying, being bearers of the divine image. So as much as we try to break, to run away from, or to rewrite the natural law, it catches up with us. There's a debt for conscience here.
Absolutely. And as we see in many times with evil, the initial reaction to doing something that's not good for you is pleasure. And the negative impacts are not there and so evident up front. And again, so much of what you're dealing with today, as some people have said, at different times is, and it was one person who Bill actually quotes in the book, who was a communist, who said, you know, my problem was I gauged capitalism on its results, and I gauged communism and socialism on what it promised. Mm-hmm. And those are apples and oranges. Right. And that's the problem. The problem is these ideas sound wonderful. I grew up during the 60s. I remember a lot of these ideas. you know, come flowing out of the Enlightenment, but then kind of after World War II into the postmodernism kind of world where it's all nihilistic coming out of France, as you were even indicated earlier, you know, Foucault and those kinds of people, where nothing really matters, you know. And so we want, why should we be surprised when we see the kind of depression and pessimism? And that's one of the things Bill actually highlights in the book. The idea that you deal with some of these people, they're so angry and they're so pessimistic and they're so unhappy. And the statistics have shown, and we talk about it on Father Spitzer's Universe a lot because he loves statistics, the idea is that people who follow a faith perspective and have a religion and are married, etc., those are happier people on a regular basis. And the people who are promoting these critical race theory concepts and all these secularized views of the world and this extreme libertarianism are miserable.
Yep. And they're miserable for so many reasons, but chief among which is every single ideology that they espouse to, like you mentioned, is at the proximate level pleasurable, but at the ultimate level personally destructive. There's a kind of self-destruction at play here. And there's an immorality on behalf of the people who are pushing this narrative as if this is going to liberate people. There's a moral debt to be owed to society that's going to catch up to us.
Exactly. And I think, and on my experience in working in the media business in New York and stuff over 20 years earlier, the thing I used to always notice was at some point saying to people, listen, you wouldn't be surprised with why you have the programming you have on the channels you're watching if you knew the people's personal life stories of the people who are creating this product and are behind making the decisions about it. Many of them come from very broken situations, and I think they project their hurt onto the rest of us. And maybe it's almost a certain amount of resentfulness over, oh, you know, you had a happy situation. Well, that wasn't my situation. And that's not the way it is for everybody. And it shouldn't be that way. And Paul Vitz talks about, and I had read a book of his years ago, but Bill quotes it here, about the idea of that so many of these radicals and people, especially in the feminist movement and just in general, have had horrible problems with authority figures, specifically their father growing up, either an absent father or a father who they couldn't get along with, which leads to this kind of anti-authority, not just authoritarianism, but anti-authority, where everybody is supposed to do what they want to do, except I want you to do how I want you to do it. It's an amazing kind of dichotomy how you have these people, and I always thought it's mystifying to me how they're all about individualism, but they're all about the fact that you have to do what's right for the state.
Right. So on the one hand, there's a kind of inherent declaration that, oh, no, we don't want government overreach, except for when we want the government to overreach.
Right. Exactly. On a personal level, I'm having all these freedoms, but at the end of the day, I have to subjugate my will for the good of the state.
And so I used to teach high school, Doug, you know this, and it used to baffle me how when you dialogue with these students, and these are for the most part either Catholic or exposed to Catholicism, there seems to be a notion that civil law is the highest law that a human person is held accountable to. And it was heartbreaking for me to see that if the state changed a law, my students would say, well, therefore this is what we have to do, and so I have to align the way I think. And actually the church and even natural law calls us to evaluate even that.
It's interesting because years ago, I was in Rome years ago. I was driving with some friends of ours who were working in Vatican Television. They were taking us out to dinner. We blew through this stop sign. It was a stop sign. And I said, you know, there's a stop sign back there. He said, oh, it's there, but nobody pays attention to it. And I said, well, you know, it's interesting because it's a different take than in the United States. We would say if there's a stop sign at a corner that no one stops at or doesn't have any value, we would say get rid of the stop sign because it shouldn't be there. But as long as it's there, I need to stop. And I think what you're pointing out is we tend to regard the law as being reflective of our new morality. So suddenly something that is legal becomes moral. It's kind of a very, I think, uniquely American way of looking at these things. At least that's in my little limited perspective that I saw between kind of an Italian perspective of kind of what you pay attention to and what you don't. And on the other side, a very American idea that, well, if this is legal, it must be okay.
I'm sorry, I'm still chuckling at that. I can't imagine doing that here in the States. But like you said, it has to do with the interpretation of law. And when we understand that even civil law is subject to the objective rule of morality, that's when we can start reclaiming right reason in the public sphere.
Right, and I think what you said exactly is reason and reasonableness and common sense, and I think that's what, you know, so many of these things are so obvious to us. It's just we everybody wants to fit in and be part of the club. Happily, I think people are starting to realize there's a lot more people out there who believe the truth, as I think about the faith as well, people who listen to EWTN Radio and EWTN.
Thank you. My guest, Duck Keck, President and CEO of EWTN. I'm Ox Peter.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Hello, I'm Marian Kuharski, the director of Pro-Life Across America. We're non-political and totally educational. We don't scream or scold. Instead, we help people working through unplanned pregnancies know their options, and we rely on people like you to help with our mission. Check us out on Facebook, YouTube, or at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
Pro-Life Across America.
Miss the beginning? Can't catch the end? Or you want to hear it again? All Ave Maria Radio programs can be heard at AveMariaRadio.net or on the Ave Maria Radio app. Then share it with your friends to help spread the Catholic faith. That's AveMariaRadio.net. When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is sponsored by Workforce Pay Hub, providing payroll, time tracking, HR management, and benefits administration, all with a dedicated customer-centric service team. More information can be found at workforcepayhub.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Berlin Wall fell on November the 9th, 1989, and as the West celebrates the 35th anniversary of this momentous occasion, we mustn't overlook the key role that Pope St. John Paul II played in bringing it about. Paul Kengor joins us. Paul is the editor of the American Spectator, and he's also a professor of political science at Grove City College and a senior academic fellow at the Center for Vision and Values. Paul, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Yeah, good, Mark. It's good to be back with you. Thanks.
Always good to speak with you. So, 35th anniversary, we've come a long way since that momentous occasion. I was 1 year old when it happened, but I remember growing up looking at those images, and John Paul II definitely had a part to play in this.
Yeah, wow, you were 1 year old. Man, you're making me feel old, I'll tell you that. I'll tell you where I was. So, I was in college at the University of Pittsburgh, I was there for when the wall fell, and going back 2 years prior to that, I think even more meaningful because the wall, slowly over a period of a few days and weeks, you kind of saw it coming, right? Even then it was a big deal.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget June 1987 when Reagan gave the Berlin Wall speech, and that was completely unexpected, where he called on, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember coming home from classes at the University of Pittsburgh. I was a pre-med major, not very interested in politics, not very political, but I knew that these big events were going on. And I turned on the evening news with a couple of my roommates. That's what you did in those days, right? It was like, ABC, CBS, or NBC. And seeing that, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and seeing that my roommate, John, I said, whoa, did you hear that? He's like, yeah, well, that was great. And then they kind of played it again, and I sort of pumped my fist. And I remember years later talking to Peter Robinson, who wrote the speech, the Tear Down This Wall speech. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know if that line from Reagan was going to stay in the speech because everybody kept taking it out. And not until, you know, so Peter did the same thing I was doing. He was watching it on TV from, I think, his apartment. I don't even think he was in the White House when he was watching it on TV. And he's like, come on, say it, say it, say it. And when Reagan said it and he saw that the line was in, he cheered.
Wow.
And he said, you know, I know it was a good line. And I know that the Gipper, you know, wouldn't fail to deliver the line because he was a great communicator.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to tell you, when I heard it, I thought, oh, he said, that's even better than I thought.
Mm.
Right. It was just so good. And moments like that, and yeah, working with people like, you know, the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, it was almost 2 years to the day of the Berlin Wall speech, Brandenburg Gate speech, that Poland held free and fair elections.
Yep.
Where, 100 seats were open in the Polish legislature. The communists lost 100 out of 100, which is why communists never hold elections. Right, because they know they're going to lose. And Mikhail Gorbachev said, I knew that when those elections took place in Poland, it was only a matter of time. And if you want to know what really breached the Berlin Wall, what really led to the kind of led up to the fall of the Berlin Wall before the wall itself went down, it was those elections in John Paul II's Poland,
mm-hmm.
in June 1989.
Yep.
So, yeah, all of that happened, 35 years ago? Wow. Yeah, time flies.
And you know, Paul, it's only been 35 years, so we can't pretend as if this is something that's confined to the annals of ancient history. But we're far enough removed that we've got generations now that don't remember a time when the free West, or at least the free Western Europe, was separated by this great iron curtain of the communist-ruled countries of the Eastern Bloc, and the persecution of the millions for their faith, for their opinions during the Cold War, as a result of the iron curtain being up. It's almost unthinkable now. It seems like the stuff of legends.
Yeah, it does. It's hard for people to fathom. And, you know, Caspar Weinberger, Cap Weinberger, who was Ronald Reagan's defense secretary, I interviewed him shortly before he died, Marcus, and he told me, he said, I want you to do me a favor. Can I make a special request? And I said, yeah, sure. He said, you're a young man. You're a young professor. At that point, I was probably in my mid-30s, I guess. He said, anytime you ever talk about the Berlin Wall or someone talks to you about it, could you do this for me? And I said, yeah, sure. What? And he said, Ask your audience or whoever you're talking to this question. In which direction did the East German guards who patrolled that wall, in which direction did they point their rifles?
Mm.
And I said, east. And he said, east, on their own people.
Yeah.
Their own people. He said, you're talking to a former Secretary of Defense. You had nations throughout all of history that put up walls to keep people from invading, to keep the enemy from invading. This was actually a wall put up to keep the people inside from escaping.
Yep.
Right? And yep. And he said, imagine that. And those East German guards patrolling that wall, they never even had to look westward, right? They knew that nobody
wanted to come in, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. No one from the West was going to be trying to crawl through the barbed wire, walk through all the landmines. Yeah, they would have just said to them, I think we need to pick someone up here and take them off to the insane asylum. This guy's trying to get in here. What do we do with this? They just had to look east. And Peter Robinson, who wrote the speech, the Berlin Wall speech, he told me that in the prep for the speech, when he went over there a few months prior to June 1987, he was flown in a helicopter over top of Checkpoint Charlie and that whole area by American military in West Berlin. And they were describing, they said, okay, now here, Mr. Robinson, there's the wall. Now you can see the barbed wire up on top. And over there, Mr. Robinson, is the raked sand. And over here is where all the land. And Peter said, whoa, raked sand? And he said, yeah. They rake the sand, and then that way in the morning they check it to see if there are any footprints in the sand. And if there's any footprints in the sand, that will mean that one of those East German guards let friends or family sneak through. So the way that they checked their own side to make sure it didn't happen was they would rake the sand and they would check it in the morning. And Peter said, you know, Peter cursed, he said, you know, the B words, right? You know, they thought of everything they could. And one of the most dramatic examples of getting over the Berlin Wall, and there was actually a Disney movie done on this in the 1980s called Border Crossing. Mm. Some East German guys who worked in a garage who were good with their hands and making stuff, they constructed a balloon, a hot air balloon. And at nighttime, they went over the Berlin Wall in a balloon. So people came up with the most novel things to try to get through. But if you tried to run through, you'd get blown up by a landmine. You could get caught in barbed wire. And you could get shot. And there were many, many people that these poor East German guards had to shoot their own people who were trying to escape. Yeah, and very sad.
I'm reminded of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's words that she remembers the thousands who were killed near the wall because they were looking for freedom. She also remembers the 70-odd thousand people who were detained because they tried to escape. But then after that, the families of those people were tortured because their relatives tried to flee. We are so far removed from this as a nation that we can't even fathom that kind of lack of liberty.
Yeah, that's right. Although to make it real and modern, Americans should think about, you know, a communist country called Cuba, which is just 70 to 110 miles south of Key West. And in fact, the American Coast Guard and some other different historical sources that have published articles on this and books. In fact, this is in the Harvard University Press book, The Black Book of Communism. It's estimated that about 100,000 people have tried to escape Cuba by swimming or floating on whatever they can get a hold of to Florida. And of those roughly 100,000, at least 40,000 died from drowning trying to do that. Now, they can't build a Berlin Wall in Havana, but they've used that ocean to try to detain people that way.
Paul, thank you for making the time to speak with us. This was wonderful.
Yeah, sure thing, Marcus. Anytime.
My guest, Paul Kengor, editor of the American Spectator, professor of political science at Grove City College. And we've been talking about John Paul II's heritage and legacy in aiding in the fall of the Berlin Wall. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Living the Beatitudes with Father Bjorn.
Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Saint Jose Maria Escriva says that we are called to light up the pathways of this earth by being sowers of peace and joy. This comes from being aware that we are sons and daughters of God. On the road of life, though, we find dangers. But God walks with us every step of our life, pouring out the gifts of His Holy Spirit upon us. Our Lady is our companion, like GPS in our car, connected to the cloud and bringing the latest updates to help us navigate our journey and get out of traffic on the way to the eternal kingdom. We don't want to get into family fights on our way to God's vacation destination, but we should be the sowers of peace and joy. We shouldn't accept substitutes, accept only the authentic identity of being His children, His sons and daughters. Let's grow in happiness and bring peace to those around us. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God.
For more about the Beatitudes, visit EWTNRC.com.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
We just did our parish mission a couple weeks ago now, and I suggested that in the course of the mission that we do something like a little mini spiritual assessment of our lives. I don't have to show this to anybody, but a great chance for us just with real honesty, just between us and Jesus, ask ourselves some questions. First question, given the fact that half of Catholics don't think God is even personal, would be to ask ourselves that. Do I think God is personal? And then to ask myself, do I think a relationship with Jesus is possible? Do I have a relationship with Jesus? And if so, what's it look like? And then perhaps a little bit more awkwardly or painfully, to ask Jesus, from His perspective, what's the friendship that we have with Him look like? How would He describe our friendship with Him? That might be a hard conversation to have.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Debates over issues such as marriage, infertility, divorce, and adoption tend to consider the issue solely from the adult's perspective and the perspective of quote-unquote rights. But what about the rights of the children? We're joined by Stacey Manning to talk about flipping the script on the conversation. Stacey is the co-author of Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. You can visit thembeforeus.com. Stacey, thank you for joining us. How are you?
The pleasure is mine. I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Stacey, I must say, this book, it's very well written, and I greatly appreciate the thought that was put into the systematic organization. There's a lot of appeal to natural law here, which means you've greatly widened the conversation on children's rights, and I think that's as good a place as any to start. It's important that we reclaim that capacity of dialoguing at the natural level why children have rights.
That's exactly right. We actually went out of our way to not make the Christian perspective a part of the book, because when, you know, someone doesn't view the Bible as an authority, you mm-hmm. cannot appeal to that authority to make the case. And this movement, it's going to have to come from everywhere on all sides. And people that want to champion the rights of children, if they're not believers, have to have the case laid out for them in a way that makes it palatable for them to go forward and share this message with their friends and family and communities.
Right, without a preconceived religious bias, and let alone the Christian bias, which unfortunately isn't received very well in the public square.
Exactly.
So let's talk about rights then. You actually opened the conversation in the book with this question of rights. And this is it's something I do on this program all the time, this question of what is a right and how can we properly understand it? Because one thing I can say for sure is we don't receive our rights from either the Constitution or the civil government.
No, we certainly do not, because they are well equipped to take them right away. The question of rights, and we went round and round about this, Katie Faust and I, my co-author, mm-hmm. Founder of Them Before Us, the 501c3 nonprofit, because it's a very difficult question to answer, and a lot of very intellectual people well above my pay grade really struggle with how to identify and describe the rights of the child. And there's a lot of contention around it. But the reality is that a child's right is a singular subject that needs to be treated very differently from the way that we perceive all other rights. Mm. And the fact that the parents of a child have a right to leave the hospital with the child that they gave birth to, the child has the very same right to leave that hospital with the parents that right. brought them into the world.
And so what you're bringing to the debate here that very few people consider is that when it comes to the rights of children, it is unfortunately or fortunately incumbent upon the parents to be stewards and to establish jurisprudence over those rights until the child comes to a point where they're able to administer those rights for themselves.
Yes.
And, well, we're not... I want to say we're not seeing in the public sphere. The truth is we are, but we're seeing tremendous abuses. So let's talk about exactly that, that it's not wrong. It's actually perfectly right and within the bounds of natural law to say that a child has a right to mother and father staying together and raising them in a stable home environment enshrined in marriage.
I couldn't agree more, but the way that we are... commodifying children in the ways of the big fertility, the IVF, mm-hmm. the surrogacy, the number of babies that are just on ice for who knows how long yeah. until the parents make the painful decision to dispose and discard of those embryos. In every way, our society is viewing children as a commodity to bring satisfaction and to fulfill the desires of all adults, no matter what assemblage of family these adults have decided to engage in, whether that's a same-sex couple or a throuple,
right? You have,
or even single mothers by choice. We have entirely eschewed the desperately important roles both mothers and fathers play in their child's development. It's a wonderfully made design, and women and men bring beautifully different things to the marriage and to a child's life. Yep. A mother cannot father, yep. and a father cannot mother. It is just simply an impossibility, and we need to be the adults in the room because we are, and recognize this bare bones fact. And that means that a lot of adults are not going to get what their soul desires. And of course, we must have empathy for people who will not realize family. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you have to make the biggest sacrifice of all when you want to be a parent. And maybe that's not becoming a parent at all if it's going to cost a child what they have a right to.
Right. And as painful as that is, that's what love really means. It entails speaking the truth in kindness, to be sure, but it entails speaking the truth. If there is no truth, then it's devoid of love. And therein lies that great conversation, that the gift of having a child, whether by means of natural procreation or any other means, adoption or whatnot, it's not for the sake of the parents that the child comes in. It's that the entry of that child into your life automatically presupposes the selfless making of a gift of oneself for the sake of one's spouse and one's child. This isn't something that's there to make me feel better about myself. From the moment I got married and the moment I had children, I signed away my self-pleasure to the extent of I am at the service of bride and children. And that's what parenting truly entails.
Yes. And it's a beautiful sacrifice. It gives life so much meaning. Mm-hmm. And when we're commodifying children, when we are buying children, or you know, having them created in a lab, and you know, perhaps even grown in another woman's body, I lost my train of thought. No, just give me a moment. We are, instead of carrying the burden, for whatever reason that we are not in a stable marriage where children are best raised, we are handing that burden off to an infant.
Right.
We are saying, I can't carry this because I'm so heartbroken, and it's so painful for me that I might not be able to have a child, that I'm going to go outside of God's plan to procure one. And that child is going to have to carry that burden for the adult for the rest of their life.
Yep.
It's the same thing that we're doing in divorce. When we give up on divorce and we give up on on the marriage vows, where we're taking this big sack of adult problems and we're handing them to the children, saying, we can't carry this as adults. Here, kids, you carry it for us.
Yeah. One of the students I used to teach, extremely, in fact, it wasn't just one, multiple of them, children of divorce tend to blame themselves, even though clearly the fault is not on them. Something in the child recognizes that there's been a breakdown of that which is truly highly good. And inevitably, because of their innocence, a lot of them wind up blaming themselves for it.
It seems inevitable to me, because they innately know that mom and dad are supposed to do the hard things mm-hmm. in order to keep them safe. And when, you know, a divorce blows up planet parent, when their two households become, or one household becomes two, or maybe they even lose a relationship with one of the parents, how could they not feel responsible? Because at the end of the day, the parents chose their convenience
yep.
or inability to overcome their problems over the well-being of the kids.
Right. My guest is Stacey Manning, co-author of Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. You can visit thembeforeus.com. We are continuing this conversation with Stacey on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Mark Speter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Did you know my mom's gonna have a baby? We heard the heartbeat and my dad said this is gonna be someone very special.
Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. We hope you'll consider supporting the work of Pro-Life Across America. Your gift will help offer life-saving alternatives to those in need. Visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org or like us on Facebook.
Pro-Life Across America.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
She was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
When we refer to our Father who art in heaven, are we talking to a God who is far removed from us? On the contrary, says the Catholic Catechism, we are talking to a Father who is close to humble and contrite hearts. We assert that God is in the hearts of the just, as he is in his holy temple. He is in heaven, his dwelling place. The Father's house is our homeland. Sin has exiled us, but conversion of heart enables us to return to the Father, to heaven. Christians are in the flesh, but they do not live according to the flesh. They spend their lives on earth, but are citizens of heaven. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Stacey Manning, co-author of Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. Stacey, we were talking earlier about the rights that children have to both their parents being together and raising them in a stable home environment enshrined in marriage. And studies have proven time and time again, cohabitating parents do not provide the same stability that a married, committed family has. But I want to take this a little deeper. One of the most powerful and moving subchapters in your whole group is in your whole book is the question of why children clamor for access and to know their biological parents. And the point that you make here from Natural Law is very salient, that biological parents confer upon the child their biological identity, and something within the child innately desires and hungers to know that, as if it's going to inform who they are as persons.
We have so many stories of children that have experienced genealogical bewilderment is the term, who were perhaps adopted or were IVF kids or sperm and egg donation children, who once they finally found out that they weren't biologically related to their mother and or father, everything made sense. They never quite felt like they belonged. They spent lifetimes of disconnectedness and otherness that they just couldn't quite put their finger on. And then the moment they knew it, like the light bulb came on. Mm-hmm. The adoptees refer to this as a primal wound. There's lots of information on the primal wound out there for adoptees and not so much for the surrogacy kids and IVF kids, but it's a wound that can't be healed. Mm-hmm. Because children innately want to know from whom they are from.
Right.
And I, you know, there's one group of kids that it's like 50 kids or something that were all sired by the same sperm donor.
Right.
And they all get together and you can watch these videos online where they're like, they're just hungry to be in one another's presence because mm-hmm. it gives them information about one another. And to that point, how dangerous a world for these poor kids. Can you imagine being one of these kids and meeting a person that got you like no one else, going down the road of marriage just to find out that it's your half-brother that you've fallen in love with.
Right, right.
I mean, we're playing with people's lives in ways that have ramifications for generations.
Yep. And that's another thing that the book highlights, that it's not just a question of biological identity from the parents. It's that children have this emptiness within themselves when they recognize that there might well be a sibling out there. And because these are their inbuilt biological best friends that they are missing out on having relationships with and even having those fights and experiences with that help them grow into wholer persons.
That's right. Watching my own children, I have three, and they're all pretty standard issue Mannings, yet they're working out life together. They have a sweet, beautiful relationship. Their dynamic is something to behold, and they go out into the world as a team. I can't imagine them having a teammate that wasn't a part of their gang. The things that they learn from one another, the things that they learn about their parents through their siblings and the different way that our personalities manifest, it's you know, being raised in that kind of environment provides you with an education that you really just can't quantify. It's a spiritual education.
Yep. And this is why when you go as far back as, say, the sexual revolution, the great lies that were sold to women have done nothing but destroy, you know, women, children, the family at large. And it's created this complete pandemic of fatherlessness that, funnily enough, it's one of the few areas I've seen where Barack Hussein Obama and Joseph Ratzinger, well, actually by then he was Benedict XVI, agree upon. They've spoken about the absence of the father in the family and how that wound cannot be replaced unless father figures step up.
It is so interesting that Barack Obama specifically, he was such a champion of getting fathers back into the homes, yet out of the other side of his mouth championed the studies, quotes, air quotes, that kids in same-sex families fare even better than kids from heterosexual households. But those two things can't be true at once.
No, they can't.
You cannot have a household headed by two women without a father and have that kid fare better. Children need both mother and father to launch the best that they can.
Yep. And that's why the abhorrence of, and again, this is not knocking on any political parties, just an objective fact, the abhorrence of the Obama administration's identification with identity politics, and then the push for abortion, especially for minority families, it did so much to damage the integral structure of the family. And it also created this entire wave of men who didn't need to be responsible for the family because the government was making sure that the lives of children terminated.
It's absolutely heartbreaking that American men don't know how valuable that they are, and how integral both sexes doing well impacts the other. You know, I'm not at my best if my husband's not doing well. My daughter is not cared for, safe, and protected if her big brother is not thriving and achieving and there to protect and defend her. We are dependent and reliant on one another for human flourishing. And nobody's contribution to the family is less or more. Both are equally important and equally imperative to launching and raising successful children.
And children can tell the difference. They can tell. That's why the experiment of polyamory, however it's been pushed ever since Obergefell especially, we can see that, I'm sorry, but the children coming out of those unions, they have true psychological issues that they're dealing with because they know that mommy and daddy don't exclusively love each other. Something is wrong with the family environment, even if they can't articulate what's going on.
Children feel uniquely loved when they see their mother and father loving one another. That's the one love that we experience in humankind that's actually transferable in a polyamorous relationship. How could a child ever experience that feeling when there's so much sexual disorder going on in their home, not to mention that the most dangerous child, or excuse me, the most dangerous person in a child's life is an unrelated male in the household. Now, that's not saying that, you know, stepfathers, or there's many a step parent out there that is doing the hard work and God bless them. But, you know, I unless you have a strong stomach, I wouldn't Google stepfather and child abuse in the same term.
And it speaks again to how there is a biological reality that translates into the spiritual reality of parenting. Now, this isn't to negate the wondrous foster father, stepfathers who have risen up and undertaken that role of fatherhood or vice versa with motherhood, where biological parenting has either, you know, fallen short, failed, or because of death or whatever. This is not a negation of that. This is just a continued conversation on how God planned for the human family. And so then you have the conversation of quote-unquote same-sex parents, right? The fact is, all that happens is one or the other of the parent winds up becoming a photocopy, a bad Xerox copy of mother or father, all in the effort of trying to create this kind of pseudo-normalcy, and children suffer as a result.
Right. You can only have one mother, and you can only have one father by design. And we're gaslighting children who are in same-sex households with the, you know, paste a happy political sticker over it. Everything's fine. You know, nothing to see here. Love is love. Well, you know, kids are not getting what they need in those environments. And when children have an opportunity to speak the truth about what they've experienced living in same-sex homes, the picture's not very pretty. Throughout our book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement, I should say that more often, we have numerous stories about kids who go to anonymous forums and actually speak their heart. When speaking your heart to your two moms is going to cost you emotionally, you're not going to tell the truth. Of course, kids are going to get up and testify that, you know, in court settings or in front of, you know, house committees that, oh, my life is fantastic. While they're sitting next to the very people who are responsible for putting food on the table, making their homes safe, or maybe even responsible for purchasing them through big fertility. That's not a safe place for a kid to simply tell the truth and to pretend like we're getting the facts from a 13-year-old whose emotional safety is depending on whether they say the right things for maybe a political outcome. It's just juvenile.
Yeah. Well, Stacey, I want to say thank you not only for penning the book, but also for doing what you're doing for children's rights. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. What a pleasant conversation.
My guest has been Stacey Manning, co-author of Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. You can visit thembeforeus.com. And I'd invite you to procure a copy of Them Before Us. This is published by Post Hill Press. And let's continue this conversation and reclaim God's plan for marriage and the family in the public sphere. Until next time, for Ave Maria in the afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter.